Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, welcome back to Deep Dish Radio. I'm Tim Powers. One of the things I love about doing this show is I get to meet people that I've always wanted to meet. I put it together specifically for that reason. And occasionally, we get to be friends. And such is the case today with comedian, actor, writer, voice actor, multi-hyphenate, and damn genius, Phil Proctor, who most people will recognize as part of the Fire Sign Theater. But there's so much more than that, and I could begin to describe it all, but it's all better described in a brand new book available on Amazon.com right now called Where's My Fortune Cookie, which is Phil Proctor's memoirs. Written with collaborator Brad Schreiber, Phil goes through his life in a very non-linear way, and you learn about a really smart kid who grew into a very smart adult who was exceptionally talented and very, very lucky and worked his tail off to get where he is today. And along the way has created some incredibly funny moments. One of them is this show. So in just a moment, right along with me, you get to meet Phil Proctor. But first, if you like what you hear on Deep Dish Radio, I encourage you to tell your friends. Find a link and forward it on. Post it on your social media. Please tweet it out to your friends. And one of the things that I would deeply appreciate is if you'd go to iTunes, leave me a good review. If you like what you hear, leave me 5 stars and tell your friends. And better yet, tell total strangers on iTunes that Deep Dish Radio is worth the time involved. I'd love to hear from you. And, of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Deep Dish Radio. You can find me on a new Facebook page, Deep Dish Radio. And the book is called Where's My Fortune Cookie? The memoirs of brilliant actor and comedian Phil Proctor. And you can get it at Amazon.com. But, of course, I encourage you to go into your local brick-and-mortar store and ask for it. I believe Barnes & Noble is carrying it right now. And you can actually visit Phil's website at planetproctor.com. See some of the other brilliant stuff that he is that he's written, and encourage you to check out everything he's done. If you're not listening to the Firesign Theater, why are you listening to this show? There's so much great stuff out there. Encourage you to check it out. And now, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, my friend Phil Proctor. Phil, I have enjoyed the book, screaming through it as quickly as I can, and as I was saying before we started recording, been a fan for a long, long time, and my years in rock radio meant that I found a lot of albums that you were a part of in the record libraries and got turned on to a lot of really great stuff. And the first thing that really impressed me as I got through the book is there are so many stories that just kind of weave in and out, which yeah. I should have expected. It's not a linear story at all. It just kind of weaves in and out of your life in chapters. And I thought, well, of course, that's exactly what it's going to do.
Yeah, we're staggering through life, Tim.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
We bravely carry on, buffeted as we are by the winds of fortune.
And the thing that struck me as I was reading it is, why is Phil telling this story now? What is it that prompted you to record.
Do I burden myself?
Yeah.
At this stage in my life?
Yeah.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, my co-author, Brad Schreiber, who has also written a wonderful book called After the Revolution, or no, Revolution's End, which is about the Symbionese Liberation Army and Patty Hearst's involvement and all that. He's receiving a lot of attention for that book. But the Symbionese Liberation Army played a part in my story as well. And Brad is also a comic writer and lecturer, and we ran into one another over the years at various performances, and both Melinda and I have contributed to some of his more humorous works that are out there. You know, I think his latest book in that vein is called, like, What's So Funny? Okay. But anyway, he convinced me that I should pay him to record my ramblings and that he would do the yeoman's work of putting it into a book form, okay? He'd carry the heavy water, right? And then get back to me with it, and I would edit it with him, and that's what happened. Because I, up to about a year ago, I really was too busy still pursuing all of these crazy directions that my life goes in, voiceover work and adding voices to cartoons and to games and to movies and to television and to major animated features, and then acting on stage with my darling wife Melinda Peterson at the Antilles Company, which now has its own theater in Glendale, great classical theater company I've been with for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And basically living life. You know, my daughter and my grandkids are now back in L.A., and my dear wife has to have an impending operation of ankle replacement surgery. So there's all this stuff going on, you know?
Right.
And I figured if I don't do it now, I may never get to it, okay? And thanks to Brad, he was able to bring me a draft that I could go through and try to make in my own voice. And also, which helped me remember things that I perhaps had said incorrectly, in my dictation to him. And there are still some errors in the book. There's a couple of names. There's some artwork that is properly attributed to the right people. It's really, really a difficult job, you know, to do a project like this pretty much on your own,
right?
Because it's all self-publishing, right? And what I basically did was that I gave advance copies to as many people that I knew who knew something about some of the stories in the book,
sure,
hoping that they would say, well, no, that's not what happened. So, you know, and I go, oh, really? Oh, you're right, yeah. Or, no, you can't talk about Peter Bergman like that. You know, I lived with him. You have to change that. Okay. And I said, okay, right. What do you want me to say? You know, and then I'd revise it to from the perspective of his wife, right? You know,
sure.
And this is important. I mean, this is the best way I could approach the fact that a book of memoirs is exactly that. You know, it's to the best of your ability to recall this stuff. Now, the other reason that I decided to write the book was that my partners were dropping like flies.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
You know, Peter Bergman, my beloved partner from Yale back in the 1958-59, when we first met, he died of leukemia about 5 years ago.
Right.
And then, much to our surprise, 2 years later, Phil Austin passed away,
right,
of similar complications of cancer, and leaving just me and Dave Osman. Dave's 80 years old. He's got like 2 stents in his heart, you know, and he's doing fine. And so I said, you know, I better write this while I still can, while I can remember most of it. And let's get it out there, not only for my fans, but because it is a psychic story. It's a story of all of the strange events and the wonderful people that I met in my life up to now, and how it kind of led me to become a member of the Firesign Theater and to pursue this really bizarre, multifaceted career that I've had. So I wanted to get that story out as well.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the multifaceted career and all the stories that are involved, and everyone who basically did quality check for your memories,
right,
throughout. But now that it's finished, right? And you take a look at a career that spans well over 50 years. What do you, the protagonist in the story, what do you walk away from? What did you learn about yourself in this? And I ask that as a fellow who is obviously incredibly self-aware and has been through most of his adult life.
Okay, good. Well, I learned that there's a path, that I've been uncovering and following, and it's still leading me to interesting places. But I guess the takeaway from the book and thinking about my life and everything is really the people that I ended up spending time with, more importantly than anything else. I think this is true for everybody. Who are you hanging with? Who do you get married to? What is your longest term relationship? Do you have kids? Did you have love in your life? You know, are you satisfied with your life? Do you feel creatively fulfilled? Are you having fun doing what you're doing? And do you feel that you're in a way enlightening yourself and enriching your spirit? Or does that have nothing to do with your life at all, and you're just in it for the money? You know what I mean?
Right.
It's all okay. They're all valid choices. But for me, it was clearly a spiritual quest and a quest to reveal and realize myself through the talents that God gave me as a baby, really. Because as I say in the book, I was born of Irish and Amish lineage, a Yoder and a McGonagall and an O'Connor getting together,
right,
back in Pennsylvania, and that's where my origins are. My great uncle Joe Yoder, who wrote the book about our family, Rosanna of the Amish, which is about this extraordinary marriage between Rosanna McGonagall, O'Connor McGonagall, and little Chris Yoder in the Valley of the Half Moon in Pennsylvania. He had my great uncle who wrote the book. He had extraordinary talents that I believe I inherited. He appeared in minstrel shows. He was an actor. He started choral groups and musical groups in schools throughout the East Coast. He lectured, he sang, and he wrote books. And he basically wrote about the Amish culture. Because at the point in his life when he had left the Amish community, because his father did so, he was one of five boys. He was the brother of one of the five boys. And he had an objective view of it. I met him, I met the man, but I feel that I inherited several traits that are probably genetic to the Yoder family, but certainly were expressed in him. As a baby, my grandfather was singing, you know, Onward Christian Soldiers or something like that to me, and I hummed it back to him. And he brought me, this is in Goshen, Indiana,
right,
where the family had settled in northern Indiana. And he brings me down to the parlor, and he sings the hymn again, and I hummed it back, and everybody was astonished. And that was the last time I ever worked for free. I learned a valuable lesson that
right
night. Okay, so anyway, yes, I mean, where did this come from? This ability, this like tape recorder in my head, ability to hear music and repeat it, and hear dialect and language and repeat it, you know, that's been a through line in my life, and I've taken full advantage of it. I speak seven languages, more or less, and can imitate, a legion more, and have done so, adding voices to numerous television shows. If you Google my IMBM or my BMIM, whatever, all of the crap that I've done over the years,
right,
you'll see this extraordinary list of things that I've been in.
Yes.
Or my voice has been in, you know? And that was an extraordinary talent that I knew I had to take advantage of. But that's the reason why Firesign Theater happened for me. Okay? Because I and the other four members of the group could all do different voices and different characters.
Right.
Okay? So when we were sitting around a table in a radio studio improvising, you know, who knows who was going to pop out of us at any particular time that would elicit a response from one of the other members in another character voice. So we're like jazz musicians, you know, riffing with different instruments and everything. So this is a long way of saying that I feel that for me, life was kind of accepting the paths that were open to me because of my peculiar talents, and learning to diversify them and take advantage of them whenever they manifested. Because I could have said, I'm going to be an actor, and I could have stayed on Broadway doing musicals, which I had great fun doing in the early years.
Right.
Or I could have been a straight actor, or I could have continued in a television career or a film career, all of which are very tempting and really fun. But somehow, the Fire Sign Theater became the driving place for my talents for, as you said, about 50 years.
Yeah, there's a path, but there were also some very deliberate choices that you made. And what I discovered as I kept reading is there was a really workmanlike, diligent process that you put into, you know, learning your craft. Nothing happened by chance. I mean, there's some luck there, but you yourself, the fire sign situation, or your fire sign career, and then also your present career in voice acting, all happened as a result of deliberate choices.
Yeah, it's true, and sometimes you regret those choices. I mean, all of us in life. I'm 77 years old, so I can talk about this crap now, you know, with a certain perspective. Like, oh, if I'd only said I was going to, if I'd only made that choice, what about? But the fact of the matter is, as I review these things in conversation with friends like you, who have also pursued careers and have made similar hard decisions at times, you know, you realize that there are really no bad decisions. You know, you choose a way to go, and that informs everything else that might have been, and it informs things that will happen to you in the future, because at least you're on your way somewhere. You know what I mean? You're on the goal path. If I had said I'm going to give all this stuff up and make shoes, you know, that would have been an entirely different kind of career choice.
They would have been hilarious shoes, Phil.
Yeah, they would have been funny shoes, but or maybe even cruel shoes. Thank you, Steve Martin.
Right.
But the fact is, I wouldn't be talking to you about a career in show business. It'd be a career in shoe business. And I don't think you'd be interested in that. You know what I mean?
If you could make it interesting, I'd talk to you about it. But yes, this is far more interesting than talking about wingtips, for sure.
Yeah, but you know, in the book, the things that are weird, like you were talking about luck, and we all know in show business, anybody who's done show business knows that there's a lot of luck involved, being in the right place at the right time for the right role, and at the right price, you know,
yeah,
can lead to an exciting film role or television role or something that makes you a star, you know, that gives you longevity. And I never had an opportunity for longevity in that regard because I wasn't as available as other actors were who were just pursuing that path. I had to say, okay, well, I can do this television guest starring part on All in the Family, but I can't read for this pilot because that's a commitment that would go on possibly for years, and I've got a Fire Sign Theater career that's going on for years. So I did have to make those choices. But the weird things that I write about in the book is like, how did the Fire Sign Theater start? It started because because of a chain of events. Going back to New York to do a Broadway musical closes, did a straight play, understudied Brandon DeWilda, who is the boy who cried, Shane, come back, Shane, child actor, very famous. We became the best of friends. He decides he's married to the sister of one of my classmates at Yale, go figure. We decide to go out to L.A. together because he wants to resuscitate his film career. We connect up with Peter Fonda. Peter Fonda is working on a movie idea, which turned out to be Easy Rider. And so we go down to the Sunset Strip, young people are having a demonstration against a curfew, right, that they want to impose on them. And so we suddenly become part of what turned out to be the Sunset Strip riots, okay? Now, during that time, I sat down, you know, because we will not be moved, I sat down on an open issue of the L.A. Free Press, which was the radical press in L.A. at the time.
Right.
I pulled it out from under my butt, and I've sat down on Peter Bergman's face.
Well, that explains everything.
It explains everything. There's a picture that says KPFK newsman Peter Bergman interviews returning Vietnam War veterans. And I said, KPFK newsman Peter Bergman? Well, I haven't seen Peter for years. Now he's on local listener-supported radio. I'll call him. So immediately the cops come in from one side, the sheriffs from the other. Everybody gets squeezed together. They create an artificial riot. Brandon gets arrested. Peter Fonda gets beaten up.
Yep.
And I was writing for the East Village Other, which was another kind of counterculture newspaper back in New York. And I held up my press card, which had a big eye on it, by the way. And I think it scared the cops. Oh, witch boy! It's a witch boy! Because they all just left me alone, right? And the next morning, I call Peter Bergman.
Right.
And he says, yeah, Phil, I'm the wizard. I said, okay, so which asylum are you in, Peter? He said, no, I'm the Wizard of Oz. I have a show called Radio Free Oz. It's on from 10 to 2 every morning, every evening, except Sunday, I think, when we all worship Satan. And it's on KPFK. Just come on down and we'll all play together.
Right.
So I go to the station that night, and I meet these two other guys, Phil Austin and David Osman, who are both affiliated with the station and the program. Okay, I think Austin was producing Radio Free Oz at the time.
Right.
And it turns out, I don't know how, Radio Free Oz was the first and only, maybe, counterculture call-in all-night talk show. Okay? So naturally, you know, it was like, well, what's your sign, man? And I said, oh, I'm a Leo. And Austin says, oh, I'm an Aries. And Osman says, oh, I'm a Sagittarian. And Bergman says, well, I'm a Sagittarian, too. Let's call ourselves the Fire Sign Theater. We were all fire signs. So perfect New Age name, right?
Absolutely.
And we started improvising together. We found that we all had the goon shows in common, which was, you know about it. Some people may, some people may not. But the goon shows were a long-running, very surrealistic half-hour crazy comedy show in England during the war years and right up into like the mid to late 50s, starring Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers. That's where he got his crazy start, right? And various other crazy cast members. But it turns out that Peter Bergman, when he spent some time over in Berlin making movies, crazy thing, he wrote with Spike Milligan for a television show.
Wow.
Right, in London. He met the great man himself, the great Irishman himself. And so there was that connection. So anyway, we found we love the goons. We love surrealistic comedy. We love crazy references. We love silly voices. We like sound effects and music melded into what we're doing, even if we have to do them with our own mouths. You know, and we started playing together on the radio, and we discovered that the audience that Peter had attracted was so far out that no matter how crazy we were in our improvisations, no matter how silly or surrealistic the premise was, that wonderful audience would stay with us and believe us and follow us into the farthest reaches of outer space if we decided to go there.
Right.
And so the Fireside Theater was born, and that led to a record contract with Columbia, and then the opportunity to do our comedy on discs, which were uncensored, really, and which, you know, people could buy and listen to in their dorms or their homes or under their beds or in their closets, right? Because it wasn't broadcast at that time.
Nope.
And so we got away with all kinds of crazy, wonderful, subversive, political and social ideas.
What
and that was eventually led to our fame.
That it's such an amazing opportunity that contemporary comedians don't have, because you know, you had such an audience. KPFK at that time had, you know, had tens of thousands of listeners who you know, were tuned in, and you had no restrictions other than, you know, your other than the law, right? You really could do whatever you wanted. You didn't have you know, you didn't have tight programming going, well, it's top of the hour, we've got to play Aqualung.
That was all later. That was that Radio Now stuff, you know, all the hits all the time, all the same.
Right.
That was later. And we, the timing for what we did, which was the middle to late 60s, when we did our first record, Waiting for the Electrician,
right,
or someone like him, that was the time when FM was just beginning to become a force in broadcasting.
Yep.
Now, what you were talking about really is narrowcasting.
Right.
What we would term narrowcasting today, which is you've got a very specific audience. But that audience was huge. Bergman had attracted it single-mindedly, okay? And he decided, among the Radio Free Eyes programs that he created, that's not the right word, spin-offs that he created, was a thing called The Love-In. He decided to throw a big psychedelic party in Elysian Park.
Right, Easter Sunday, right?
On Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
Inviting bands to come and play, people to come and smoke pot and get high and have fun, and you know, and the fire. I don't think the fire sign performed. I performed as a Russian poet named Gavnov, and I read some kind of Russian poetry to the microphone. But he attracted something like 40,000 people. 40,000 people showed up, you know, and that was when we all kind of went like,
right,
what happened here? What's going on? And that was the beginning of the understanding that there was a wider audience, really, than just the radio audience. That, you know, that we were attracting the rock generation to our particular form of comedy, and we were later labeled the jesters of the rock generation by Life magazine or something like that, you know, and later, the Library of Congress, when they inducted one of our albums, Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, into their historical recordings back in 2007, they called us the Beatles of comedy. And it's true to a great extent, because we were creating long-form comedy records, much like the Beatles' story-form records, Dr. Pepper and... oh my gosh, a legion of them.
Right.
You know, fully, you know, very lovingly produced, lavishly produced, with almost a story, a surrealistic, poetic story being told in one LP disc, okay? And that's what we were doing with comedy.
Yep.
Multi-layered comedy. So and we would listen religiously to the Beatles records when they came out, as soon as we could get our hands on them. And that's why in Nick Danger, Third Eye, which was the parody of the noir detective,
right,
radio shows and movies that opened, that reached a wider audience, because people kind of could glom onto what we were making fun of, whereas some of the other records are much more surreal. Don't Crush That Dwarf is about channel surfing, click, 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 predicted all of that. I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus is about the computer revolution,
right,
which influenced Steve Jobs, which is why if you talk to Siri and you say, this is Worker speaking, hello, she'll say, hello, Clem, what function can I perform for you, LOL. Right?
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, and that's because Steve Jobs was a fire sign fan, and he put that in as an homage to the I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus. The character I played, Clem, who the computer wrongly called Clem, because I hesitated. What's your name? Clem. Hello, Clem. Clem was, in this album, was a hacker who planted a virus in a government computer,
mm-hmm,
that brought down the entire government future fair. Okay? So, and we didn't use those words, but that's what I was doing.
Yep.
And if you listen to that record, you'll see that that's what I was doing. And he recognized that we were writing about the future of computing and the home computer, And when I met him, I'd done voices for A Bug's Life, along with Dave Osman.
Right.
And we met him, we met Steve Jobs, because he had invested in Pixar. We met him at the cast and crew screening up in Oakland, and he said, "I'm a big fan of yours." And I was floored. So anyway, I mean, these are all the twists and the turns and things. So it's not, my story isn't a story of good luck. My story is a story of coincidence that cannot be explained, phenomenal coincidences that happen on a kind of an invisible world level. When you read the book, you'll see there's so many of them mm-hmm. that happen. Okay, I'll give you one more example.
Sure.
And then you can lead me somewhere else.
I'll try.
Okay, Firesign Theater. And how it started with me finding a picture of Peter Bergman at that event. And a few years later, I went back to New York to close up my apartment on 312 West 11th Street, right out from the White Horse Cafe. Because I'd been raised in Manhattan after Goshen, Indiana.
Right.
And at school at the Allen Stevenson School, Riverdale Country School, and then up to Yale before I ended up. And Bergman had written lyrics for musicals I starred in at Yale, written by Austin Pendleton,
crazy,
who I just saw back in New York.
Right.
So that was the connection with Bergman that goes back to the 50s. So anyway, I'd gone back to close up my apartment, and I connected up with a friend of Brandon and mine, named Diana Dew, who had invented electric clothing for the disco era. This brilliant, beautiful woman, there's a picture of her in one of her dresses
right.
in my book. She invented dresses that were strips of translucent plastic that would hold a light charge, okay, and glow with a light charge. And you could control the blinking of these strips in the dress or the tie or the belt or the vest to coincide with the rhythm of the music on the dance floor. And in the terms of the dress, you could also make it go around in a circle. So there were these incredible blinking electric dresses that she invented. And she and I we had an affair, and I was living with her and her girlfriend. Oh, those were the days in the East Village. Oh, my God, what a lucky man I am. You know, and at a certain point, I knew that this was over. It was over. And I had to make a decision, and I had to go back to L.A. So we go downstairs in her apartment, and we're going to have this serious conversation. And the phone rings. She picks it up. He says, "It's for you." And I pick up the phone, and it's Peter Bergman in Los Angeles. And he says, "Hey, Phil, we just signed a contract for our first record with Columbia. It's going to be called Waiting for the Electrician or someone like him, based on a skit that we did together. And we need you to come back so we can get started writing and recording. There is a ticket waiting for you at Columbia Records." Right, right. So I said, "Diana, it's happening, you know. Mwah! Goodbye." I gotta go. Destiny calls. So the next thing I know, I'm sitting in Bergman's. I was living in Bergman's Laurel Canyon house with David Osman and his wife Tiny, who were also living there, and Phil Austin and his wife. They lived in Laurel Canyon, so he'd come in for the writing sessions, and we all started this incredible process of writing for records together. You know. And again, how is that possible? How did that happen? I have no idea. I'm telling the truth, and I tell it in the book because I feel that that's the story that has to be told. You know?
Yeah, and it's really and that's the through line. So many things just happen. So many opportunities are presented to you where you're prepared. You're like, "All right, phone rang, gotta go." And
yep,
and
that's
it
right.
it
has that happened to you in your career, Tim?
Gosh, you know, it's funny. No. Mm-mm.
Okay, well, I know it's happened to other people, and I think it happens more to people in show business.
Yeah.
Than in, you know, because we're really out there. You know, you read for something, and you don't get the job, And then maybe in 3 months they call up and said, hey, you know that thing that you read for? Yeah. Well, they want you to do another part in it, right? It's a recurring role. Oh, okay. You know, so which is an indication that what we do in our life makes impressions on people.
It's true.
Okay?
Yep. I retract my no. There are some things happening right now as a result of all that stuff. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
There you go. And I think if anybody investigates their life, they will find that that's often the case. You know, whether it's just like you meet the love of your life, your soulmate, under some bizarre circumstances, and you know, and you're happily married for your entire life, you know, or you go through the worst divorce you've ever gone through in your life, you lose everything, and you start all over and become a multimillionaire. I mean, you know, it's all the old universal crapshoot, really, and it depends on your attitude, right?
Right.
Whether you're going to carry on or whether you're going to throw in the towel, you know. And those of us who carry on are the ones that have the most fun in life, even though we sometimes face great adversity. Now, are you going to ask about the title of the book or this other bizarre coincidence that happened?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I actually got a copy of this book while I was in Vegas, 2 days before Vegas was Vegas. And
read
that story on the plane. And when I landed, I learned about what happened and that I had just escaped from. So, yes, Phil, tell me about the title of this book and what it's all about.
Okay. And you just exemplified absolutely why I had to write this book. The opening chapter of the book is about, okay, I never got my fortune cookie. Let's see what it's called. Where's My Fortune Cookie? Okay.
Right.
Where's My Fortune Cookie? And the illustration on the front cover by Bob Grossman, who was Peter Bergman's roommate at Yale.
Man.
Okay. Yes. Was in the Rolling Stone magazine, and it's a picture of me and Peter cowering under a small round table with Chinese food on it. And the reason that that illustration is there is that the book opens with the story of our involvement in what is known as the Golden Dragon Massacre. 40 years ago, this September, in San Francisco Chinatown, Peter and I had done a performance. We go the only place it was open that our friend Dr. Bill Alexander wanted to take us to was the Golden Dragon, the most popular restaurant in San Francisco Chinatown at the time. It was 2:30 in the morning. I'm bending over, having a second cup of soup, and I hear bang, bang, crash, crash, scream, scream, and I feel stuff flying over my head. And I cautiously looked up with my eyes, and I see three Chinese guys, one with a machine gun, another one, automatic rifle, same thing, another one with a pistol, one with a shotgun, and they've just killed two people in the table in front of us. So I dive under the table where there's a nice steel column, okay, and I make myself as small as I possibly can. I change into a pencil, okay, and I hide behind this thin steel column. And Peter, trusting me, nobody sees me go under the table. He, with his back to the shooting, drops down on the floor, makes himself as inconspicuous as possible. And Bill Alexander drops to the floor, but he's been shot. Okay, a machine gun slug has ricocheted off the floor and has entered the heel of his boot right at the seam, not even a bullet hole, and he's still carrying that machine gun slug behind his knee to this day, 40 years later, because it's too hard to take out. All right, so the shooting goes on. I'm lying there. I had learned that morning that my wife was pregnant. My Norwegian wife, Barbro Semingsson, was pregnant with my daughter, Kristen. Didn't know who it was yet. And I'm lying there, you know, with the possibility of facing death or dismemberment or God knows what, responsibility. It was like a yin and yang situation going on in my mind. I'm either going to die, no responsibility, or I will be wounded. I'll be wounded, responsibility, what am I going to do? Or I'll have a child, and I'll have to raise that child for the next 50 years, responsibility. And it was entirely out of my hands. But the shooting stopped. It was a gang war. It was a retaliation shooting by the Joe Fong gang, who were controlling Chinatown at the time,
right.
Even though Joe Fong was in prison, and the Hua Qing, the young Chinese, who were watching when this happened. And they were sitting at a table to the left of me, about three tables back in the corner. And the moment that this thing happened, they all dropped under the table so that the murderers couldn't find them. And five people were killed, all innocent, and 11 people were wounded, all innocent. And the Hua Qing, they just filed out immediately after the killers left the room. Well, at that time, Tim, this was lauded in the newspapers as the greatest mass murder in American history.
Oof.
Five killed, 11 wounded.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yes, let's just ponder that and remember the victims right now. And I'm welling up with tears just thinking about this. What's happened to our country? What's still happening? So anyway, here's the kicker. The entire event had been predicted to me a few months earlier by a psychic girlfriend of mine.
Oof.
Her name was Sharon, and the way that I reconnected with her was absolutely crazy, totally psychic. It had to do with the fact that I was reading about this guy, Uri Geller, who was bending spoons and had contact with UFOs. And I said to Peter, we were in Chicago, I said, well, I got to meet this guy. And we go to New York. We're interviewed by Tony Hiss for the New Yorker magazine, Talk of the Town, because we were playing alien characters, Zippo and Gorko from the planet Beepo, or Zippo and Beepo from the planet Gorko. It doesn't matter. To aliens, it's all the same. And anyway, I go to the gig at the Bottom Line, and there's a message for me from a girl named Sharon. I don't know a Sharon, in an area code that looked like Woodstock. And here was the message. Uri Geller wants to meet you. Huh?
Unreal.
So unreal. So I go on the stage and I do some comedy. Oh, yeah, Uri Geller, born with a bent spoon in his mouth. Blah, 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 blah. All right? Yeah, yes, it's still funny.
Right.
So I call Sharon. I find out it's Sharon, a girl that I had spent some time with when I was sharing a house in Encino with Jeremy Clyde of Chad and Jeremy fame. Still a good friend, by the way. We see in London whenever we can. And this was a huge mansion owned by a radiologist named Dr. Adolf. It had an ape cage, a flaming tiki fountain, and an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and a bomb shelter where we kept our marijuana. Okay? All right. Again, this was the 60s, the late 60s.
Right.
We had, you know, hot and cold running girls all over the place living with us. It was a huge house, and we had these wonderful bacchanalian naked swimming parties every weekend. And still, the Firesign Theater would come over, and we'd write our next record. That was the world that we were in. It was absolutely, it was exploding. It was amazing. It was a bohemian world, okay? And the LP record industry was just starting. It was just growing in strength. And FM radio was just starting. And we were all on the brink of these amazing rides, these great successes. And we were all hanging out together. I hung out with the Stones. I hung out with Mike Oakes and Phil Oakes. I hung out with... what's his name? Donovan. I mean, you name them.
Yeah.
We were all like pals because it was just beginning. We were all artists. Even Dylan. I met Dylan. We were all artists who were just starting our careers, okay? So, anyway, I go up and I visit with Sharon. And Sharon, we catch up on a lot of things. And she says at one point, she tells me all about the UFOs and about the signs of the UFOs, which for me is lights going on and off. It's in the book, I think, but I don't know if I go into it in detail, but it's still going on. It's amazing. It's still going on. It's still going off. Lights as a sign that the aliens are really there. Please,
right.
Don't get me started. Stop me. So anyway, she says, I have to tell you some bad news. You and Peter are going to be involved in a gangland shooting. After a performance, people will be killed and wounded around you. It will involve foreigners, but you and Peter will get out unscathed. Okay?
Okay.
You still there?
Yep.
Well, I'm still here.
Good.
But when that shooting was happening, I wasn't thinking about that. It wasn't until like maybe a week afterwards that I went, oh, my God, Sharon predicted this whole thing. And she did. But why is the book called Where's My Fortune Cookie? Okay, it's true that after that event happened, Peter and I had to fly to Boulder, Colorado to do a performance of Procter & Bergman. And it's true that, you know, part of our material was, you may have seen on the news, the Golden Dragon Massacre. We were there, okay? But luckily, I ordered the duck.
Yep.
And then Bergman said, and I ordered the scared prones. Ha, 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 ha. A little more obscure. And then he said, but I never got my fortune cookie. Now, that's not why the book is titled that. Many years later, when Peter passed away, one of the patrons of the Firesign Theater, a woman named Gretchen Steiner, ordered fortune cookies for his memorial service at down in Venice, California.
Oh.
And I said, Gretchen, this is so dear of you to order these fortune cookies. It had Peter's name, his date of birth and death, and a quote from Firesign Theater album. I said, that's just wonderful. And you did it, you know, because of the gangland massacre, the shooting. She said, what? I said, Gretchen, you know, the shooting, the Chinese shooting. Peter and I survived the worst massacre in American history at the time in 1977. She said, you did? I said, wait a minute. You, Gretchen, you don't know about this, but you made these fortune cookies. Why did you do this? And I swear to God, this is what she told me. She said, because Peter came to me in a dream and said, I never got my fortune cookie. Okay?
And that's exactly what you get in this book. Oh, my God. If you're not reading this book, you're missing out on so many great stories.
If you want to get in touch with me, I'm at planetproctor.com. If you're interested in more Firesign Theater material, which is being released on a daily basis by Taylor Jessen,
no kidding,
our archivist, okay, you can go to firesigntheater.com. And this is just between you and me, but soon there may be an important announcement about the Firesign Theater archives coming from the Library of Congress in Washington, AC/DC. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned for that. This book is available wherever you get your books. And
Amazon.com,
but I love to send people into their local brick-and-mortar record store or brick-and-mortar bookstore and ask for this stuff. So I encourage you to do that as well.
Well, we haven't printed them in brick-and-mortar yet, but that would be a way to really ensure that they would, you know, it would stay around for a while.
There you go. There you go. It's interesting. Amazon when I pulled up this book on Amazon just to look it up, they recommended packaging it with one of my favorite Firesign products or one of my favorite Procter products, J-Men Forever, available on DVD.
Yeah.
I would not be doing myself any favors if I didn't say that was one of my favorite things. It actually launched my love of comedy. Completely.
Oh, that's wonderful. Tell your listeners a little bit about it.
Okay. The premise is, it is a, it, it's, old.
Maybe I should tell them about it. I'll tell them about it.
All right. You know what? Let me give it a shot. Let me give it a shot.
Okay, I'm listening.
Okay,
I'm listening.
What we have are bits of old movie serials that have been overdubbed with a through line.
Right.
Right. And basically it's superheroes fighting for goodness and niceness, as the lightning bug tries to corrupt the world through sex and drugs and rock and roll. And
And
you and Bergman play J-Men, in your wraparound segments, in your fedoras and fat ties. And,
yeah, black and white 40s style.
Black
right?
and white 40s style, and everything is overdubbed, and just your soundtrack is great. You got Billy Preston on the soundtrack. You got Machine Gun Kelly, right? Doing.
Yep. I just worked with him, by the way. He looks great. He's still got that great voice.
Yeah, he does.
Okay? Yeah, and lots of other wonderful actors from all the people that we worked with. But we got these Republic cliffhanger serials from a guy named Bud Gruskoff, and the producer of this movie, which was originally called The Secret World War,
right,
before Peter and I were called in to completely destroy it and rewrite it. right. Patrick Curtis, he was the manager of Raquel Welch before she was Raquel Welch. She was, you know, Esmeralda González Tárez or something like that.
Right.
But anyway, he made her career. He married her. He made her. And then, but his claim to fame, Patrick Curtis, producer of this film, who hired Procter & Bergman, he's the baby in the arms of Scarlett O'Hara in the Burning of Atlanta scene from Gone with the Wind. I know.
Right.
I'm so glad he didn't get burned up in that scene, right?
It was just a movie, though. It's okay.
Yeah, so anyway, Bud Gruskoff wanted to exploit the old cliffhanger serials, Captain Marvel, Captain America, Batman, you know, and we were allowed access to certain characters, and others, you know, were being saved for blockbuster movies sometime in the dim, you know, as yet unforeseen future.
Right.
But we cut them all together, as you said, into a story, and then we overdubbed our own take of this story into the mouths of all of these characters. And the superheroes, if you remember, are just as vicious and sadistic as some of the
villains. Oh, they're horribly violent, especially the Captain Marvel serials, where he's throwing people off a roof and stuff.
Yeah, I know. So in a way, you have to say that that's predictive of the kind of superhero movies that we have been subjected to over the years, you know, because starting with RoboCop, my whole problem with these movies, and I'm a fan, I admit it,
sure,
but my whole problem with these movies is the ultra-violence of them all and the fact that innocent extras are being destroyed at an incorrigible rate in these movies. The collateral damage in these CGI movies is incalculable.
So you've seen Man of Steel, where he destroys the entire city of Metropolis in a fight.
Yeah, well, it had to be done to save the city.
Right. Sure.
Right?
It does.
Mm-hmm. That's the moral dilemma that we live in right now. Are we, you know, is Little Rocket Man going to go up in a blaze of nuclear glory along with San Diego? You know, is that a fair trade? I don't know. The Old Town is still a great draw.
Yeah, it really is.
Know?
It's
and
nice.
There's some great breweries down there. I don't want to see them get radioactive. So anyway, I mean, I'm being funny, but I'm also being deadly serious. Because we've really advanced. We haven't advanced very far from when I was a kid growing up in New York and practicing air raid drills on the weekends, right?
Yeah.
And hiding under my desk. So anyway, nonetheless, that movie, J-Men Forever, is a cult favorite, and it deserves to be. And it is available. It's true. We also, Firestein just put out a 2-DVD set of our films, because we did do a bunch of films, including Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Right.
Okay. And that's like 7.5 hours of our film work. And we're now digitizing other material, so we'll be coming out with similar archival television and film stuff for our fans. And but also, if you're interested in the radio years, there's this wonderful book. If you don't have it, I got to get you a copy. It's called Duke of Madness Motors, and it contains an MP3 with like 85 hours of our radio show.
Oh, man.
Now, if you don't have it.
I don't.
Okay. After we've recorded, I'll give you my email address, and I'll see that you get a copy, okay, and maybe some other stuff as well, because Christmas is coming.
I'd be honored. Thank you.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's the pitch, and it's, again, it's an extraordinary thing that even though I turned down the opportunity to do other movies, I did a wonderful film called A Safe Place with Tuesday Weld, Orson Welles, Jack Nicholson and Gwen Wells, Henry Jaglom's first movie. And I've done recently little roles in films, and I'm on television on PBS right now in Francis Scott Key, After the Song, which is a documentary about the attempt to end slavery, the abolitionist movement at the end of the 18th century. Yes, that's right. And I play a character named John Randolph of Roanoke. And it's a three-part PBS series. You'll have to wait and see if it shows up on your local station. But you can go to the website, fskey.com, to find out where it might be showing. And I'm very proud of that work. It was created by a fellow named Philip Marshall.
Right.
Anybody with the name Philip, I love immediately anyway.
Of course.
Okay. And Philip, he interviews us, real historical characters, as ghosts. So everything we say is in our own words, as was historically written. And my character, John Randolph, had apparently a very high, annoying voice. And I used to hold court in the Virginia Senate for, you know, hours on end, but I would show up with my two white Afghan hounds and my beautiful little black serving boy, dressed in full livery, kind of Chinese style. You see, this character, John Randolph of Roanoke,
right,
had inherited hundreds of slaves from his father, and it was his life's goal to free them all, which he did on his deathbed, and he set aside land for them, but it took them, because of the obstructionists, took them 10 years for those people to settle as free men and women in the land that he designated for them. But it's an amazing story. Francis Scott Key was an abolitionist. He wanted to create a new state in Africa for all of the freed slaves to return to. That was his dream.
Wow.
And my character, who was, I guess, a closeted gay, although, you know, I don't want to spread any stories out of school, but I had a picture of Francis. I had a crush on Francis Scott Key. And this guy had a picture of him at the foot of his bed. So every morning I would wake to his beautiful, smiling face, and every night I would blow a kiss to the portrait before I went off into my dreams. You know, come on, this is all true stuff, but it still makes your head kind of explode, because you see, again, how little things have changed, really, over time.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of our evolution, our emotions, our sexual identities, you know, our striving for good and kindness, and try to better the world and better our society. It's a never-ending quest, you know. So be of good faith. It will continue. There will be a PT, a post-Trump world, right,
yeah,
where we might be able to reinstate everything that he has destroyed again. But, you know, we have to carry on. We really do. And for a satirist like me,
yeah,
this is such a rich time. You know, I do a thing called Planet Proctor.
Right.
And if you go to planetproctor.com, you'll see past issues. I've been doing it for like 25 years, because in the times that I wasn't working with Firesign Theater, I still had to write satirically. I just had to. It was now ingrained in me. And so I continue the tradition. And I'll send you, when we exchange emails, I'll send you the last couple of editions, and I'm sure you'll contribute to them in the future. But, it's, you know, I think it's amazing that the major spokespeople for satire today. And satire is important to keep us laughing.
Really. Yeah.
A friend of mine, Swami Beyondananda, I don't know if you know Swami Beyondananda's work, but he is doing a seminar now called Defying Gravity.
Okay.
How to use levity to survive the Trump years.
Yeah.
Okay? Defying gravity. That's very much my philosophy. And yet, I also believe that we need to get involved. Because, remember, Far Side Theater came out of the anti-Vietnam War movement
right.
of the 60s, right? It was very focused. And it was also the sexual revolution and the fact that the younger people wanted to have more of a voice in what was happening. Well, we failed there, I'm afraid. But to finish my point, I find it very interesting that the people who are the go-to places for comedy today are John Oliver, Stephen Colbert, Sandra Bee, Samantha Bee, excuse me, you name it. They're basically comedic spokespeople who have Bill Maher,
yeah.
Right. I mean, these guys. And who's the other guy who retired who may be coming back? Him. Okay?
Yeah.
So, that's the hope. That's where you go for your laughs now. And yet, really, I mean, I laugh every day at the shenanigans that come out of the Trump White House. Can't help it.
Right. Well, that's the gift that we comedians have.
Yes.
You know, when I first came to L.A., an old TV writer who used to write for Burns and Allen and wrote for Jack Benny sat me down one time and he said, Tim, I got to tell you, comedy's in your bones. You can't learn funny. And you, Tim, got funny bones. And, you know, Phil Proctor has funny bones and Mark Maron has funny bones. And, you know, people like us just have that genetic predisposition to satirize or to be funny. Unfortunately, our culture tries to shut down satire in political correctness. But what I've learned is that's kind of always happened. In the 50s, Harvey Kurtzman published Mad Magazine, and instantly everyone was like, it rots your brain, you know?
You're absolutely right. And look at Carlin's career.
Yeah.
I mean, the ultimate curmudgeon. I love Carlin because he hated everybody, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he really said all politicians were game to him.
Sure.
But it's true that most conservatives seem to lack the comedy gene, you know? They really do. And what passes for comedy in conservative land is really meanness and kind of bigoted views of things, belittling people, whereas the satirist is basically saying the emperor has no clothes.
Right.
Okay? And just saying, look, this is what it is. Can you see it for what it is? There it is. This is funny. Remember, laughter empowers people because it takes power away from the powerful. Okay?
Right.
You know, if you laugh at something, it means it doesn't have power over you. Okay? And that's why laughter is important. It's a liberating force. And Fire Sign Theater, from the very beginning, what the four of us seemed to have in common was the understanding that by using the material that was out there, we could deprogram people from believing everything that they hear.
Right.
So that, you know, ultimately our message was everything you know is wrong.
Right.
Right? You know, don't accept everything that you hear. Check it out. Think for yourself. Live your own life. Don't get too affected by it. You know, and follow the power of love. Love is all there is. When in doubt, you know, ask your heart.
Right.
And you'll get the right decision.
Yeah. Fire Sign was never mean-spirited. You know, they say every joke has a victim, but it was never mean-spirited, and it was never inflicted to hurt anybody. And that was kind of the through line that I always saw, the connection. You know, and this may be hacked to point out, but the connection between the fundamental American satirists of all time, the Marx Brothers, and Fire Sign, where you guys were, all eight of you were puncturing pomposity and arrogance and for lack of a better term, just the bullshit in culture and in human nature, just going, all right, you know what? We know it's there, but for heaven's sake, don't buy into it all.
That's absolutely right, Tim. And we can add to that Mark Twain.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Anybody with the name Mark's, you know, fits into that category. And I'm glad that you recognize it. Now, I should mention also, because your last name is Powers, that one of the projects that Peter and I were working on before he passed away was a transcription of a comedy series that we did on a show called Heat on National Public Radio called Power.
Okay.
And it's a parody of the Hollywood scene in the 90s. We did this like 92.
Oh, boy.
And it's now available as a book, all these wonderful scripts. And by God, they're just as comic, pertinent, and contemporary and funny now as they were then. And that's available on Bear Manor Press, which Bear Manor Media, which is, you know, a boutique a publishing company that really has published a whole bunch of Fireside Theater material. Now, this is most of it's available, as I say, firesidetheater.com. But you can find the Bear Manor Press stuff if you go to Bear Manor Press.
Bear Manor Press.
Bear
and there's
Manor
all,
Media.
Yeah, there's a lot of things of interest to Deep Dish listeners on Bear Manor. But this sounds fascinating, and it's something really to get. Get your hands
on. It really
on.
Is fun.
I want to ask you about...
What are you up to? What are you up to next before we say goodbye?
Funny you should ask. I am actually launching, finally, as I coast in the middle age, a voiceover career not unlike the one that you are flourishing in right now. I started at 18 as a radio disc jockey and had this voice my entire life. Loved it, loved radio, loved, you know, freeform radio. And I got to play with that just as it was dying. And then had a marriage and that kind of derailed, that career and had to do the suit and tie thing for a while. Came to LA, you know, that marriage ended. I came to LA. I was a stand up for a while. And still perform, still write. I've got a couple of comics that are being published very soon. And I got a second marriage where things are great. And as I started to release, the things that happened to me in my 20s, things started to happen to me in my late 40s. And coincidences, not unlike what I've read about in this book, are starting to come together and things are starting to weave together. And people that I've met are presenting opportunities and I'm being remembered for things that I did years ago. And people are saying, well, now it's time for this to happen. And I'm just leaning into it, man. It's been fantastic.
You know, I am very, very gratified and touched to hear that, because that really is, that is what I think the book is about.
Yeah.
And you see, and as a young person, you're now embracing the faith, embracing the fact that these things, your past is behind you, your present is your future, you're living in the now, and you're moving forward. And all these good seeds that you sowed in the past are coming to, you know, they're going to build a big maze that you'll never get out of.
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting things happening.
I made a cruel joke, but the fact is that every seed that you planted is going to be a nutritious plant that you will be able to eat to fulfill. It's
right.
A terrible metaphor, but you know what I'm talking about.
I don't mind being in the maze as long as I can eat. I don't care. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And
you know, that's a good point. If you're trapped in a maze that's made of corn, you'll never get hungry. You'll never die, even if you never get out of that maze.
Right. You'll be fine. You're fine. See, I made Phil Proctor laugh. That's awesome. Yeah, so that's me. I want to ask about one more thing. We are big fans of elephant parts here at Deep Dish Radio.
Oh my goodness. Michael Nesmith, right?
Right, Michael Nesmith, who was also involved in some of the Nick Danger products. But
he did a video called Nick Danger in the Case of the Missing Yolks.
Right. And you worked on Elephant Parts, the first video to win a Grammy. And
that's right.
And you worked with the great Bill Deer, who has this incredibly storied career as well.
Yes, absolutely right. So great to hear you know these people, and admire them. That's wonderful.
Yeah, very much. In fact, Nesmith is playing in L.A. on Saturday.
No kidding.
Yeah, he's going to really? Be he's going to be at the Saban Theater Saturday night at 8 o'clock. He's a guest with Felix Cavallari and Mickey Dolenz.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Well, here's what's happening in my life.
Yeah,
my darling wife Melinda Peterson, my co-acting friend. We do all kinds of recreations of old-time radio shows together. That's our passion. Then I'll be performing at the REPS, which is the, let's see what they call, Radio Enthusiasts of Puget Sound.
Wow.
Convention in March, in April, I think it is. And I'll be raising money for Des Arts Performs in Palm Springs with my wife and Fred Willard and maybe Martin Mull as well on March the 7th and 8th. Des Arts Performs on the air, fifth year on the air. These are, you know, using old-time radio shows to raise money for various things or simply to play to enthusiasts who want to keep old-time radio alive. You were talking about Mad Magazine. We'll get back to the thread in a minute. Mad Magazine, great, great influence on me. I wrote several letters to them, which are published in their collected works. And Bob and Ray.
Yes, Bob and Ray.
Bob and Ray.
Yes, Bob and Ray.
Bob and Ray, two of my greatest heroes. And I used to write funny postcards to them, which they'd read on the air.
That's awesome.
My first writing publicly exposed on the air was on the Bob and Ray radio show in New York, because I used to listen to it in the morning before I went off to school. And then Ernie Kovacs.
Oh, yes.
Ernie Kovacs. Mm-hmm. He was the most surreal of them all, and I just ate him up, you know, because he was doing surrealistic live television.
On network television.
Yeah, network television. Genius, genius. So anyway, some of the influences that I sometimes forget to mention. And let's see, now the thread went back to
old-time radio, and then all the way back to Bill Deere and Elephant Parts.
Bill Deere, yeah. Repo Man.
Yeah.
Bill Deere. Did you get to know his work through the Firesign piece or through Repo Man or something else? How do you know him?
Through Elephant Parts, actually.
Elephant Parts. I'd forgotten that that's where he started. That's why he knew Firesign Theater, of course.
Yep.
And, you know, Elephant Parts was part of the time when I also appeared in Amazon Women on the Moon.
Right.
Okay? And Lobster Man from Mars, where I had scenes with the great Tony Curtis.
Yeah, you did.
Okay? But that was the time when Michael did that, where those kinds of wonderful short-form movies were all the rage. Oh, and by the way, that started, really, if you think about it, with Tunnel Vision by Neil Israel.
Yeah.
Okay?
Oh, you're right.
Where I played the head of the network, and I got that job right off of, that was like 1972, something like that, right after doing Henry Jaglom's The Safe Place with Orson Welles and Jack Nicholson. And, you know, that was kind of like a little burp in the Firesign career where I was able to do some movie work. And those cut-up movies, I'm telling you, they're the best. And when you look back at, like, Tunnel Vision, you'll see Chevy Chase and all kinds of people who went on to have great careers, you know. But we were all absolutely so excited to be able to be part of these crazy movies and also television shows. I was in a television series, surrealistic comedy series called No Soap Radio.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
With John LaRoquette and, oh, God, I can't even remember.
ABC's Thursday at 9.
You know that. You know that show. You're amazing.
Thank you.
I guess you have magical powers.
I have funny bones, Phil. I have been a fan of comedy as long as I can remember. And you kind of kicked that snowball down the mountain. Yes, No Soap Radio. I even got the reference in the title, which was fantastic. What a weird show. How many episodes did that run?
Oh, I don't know. I have to Google it. You know, one of the things about a career, and I have a career, which means that I'm always looking at my rear. I'm always looking backwards. I'm in a car that's moving forward, and I look back to my rear of the car to see where I've been. You know, you move so rapidly. If you're lucky and you have a lot of these experiences, pardon me, most of mine of which are very diverse, I really have to use the search instrument if I want to find out, because I have a terrible sense of chronological memory. I'm just awful. And so I have to utilize the tools at our disposal to say, oh, my God, look at all the people who were in that show. And that went from then to then, and I did it then. And oh my, I mean, you know, it's revealing and it's fun for me, but it's not something that's on the tip of my iceberg, if you catch the reference.
I get it.
Or the drift, that matter, because icebergs drift.
Yes, they do. Yes.
And I'm not frozen in time yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
You're not crunching. You're not collapsing giant ocean liners.
That's right. And I'm not displacing Disney in the cryogenic tube. You know, so it's okay.
Okay.
Cryogenics me a river, please.
Ooh.
That's a Bergman.
Yeah.
That's a Bergman.
That's
one.
A beautiful
I will
one.
Not take responsible for that moan.
That is absolutely beautiful. Are you kidding? This has been so much fun. Let's plug the book one more time. Give me the title.
Where's My Fortune Cookie?
Available.
Where's My Fortune Cookie? I guess you could put a comma in there if you wanted to.
Give me an A, B, and C read on the title.
Oh, I see. Three different reads. Oh, you had to do it like this. Oh, that was Gutfeld, but let's have some fun with it this time. You just got to give me an ABC reading on it, will you?
Phil, that's great. Can I get a read? Can I get an ABC on that? Thanks.
Okay, I thought the last one was great, but okay, hold on here. Where's my fortune cookie? Here too, trying to be. Where's my fortune cookie? That's not politically correct. Okay, let's try one more. Where's my fortune cookie?
There you go. And you know they're going to pick the Mickey Rooney from Breakfast at Tiffany's read, too, and put it out there, right?
Right, which also starred Kip King in a featured role. Do you know who he is?
Wait, I should. I really
Kip
should.
Kip King, Groundlings.
Right.
Okay, and what's his son's name? Chris Kattan. And he when you see that movie and you see he delivers Chinese food or something, okay?
Right.
Kip King I'm talking about. He looks like Jerry Lewis. And Jerry Lewis picked him as his protege to succeed him when he died. Now, of course, Kip King died much earlier than Jerry Lewis.
Right.
But if you see that movie, you'll go, oh, my God, that's a young Jerry Lewis. And Kip had this strange history with Jerry where until he reached a certain point where he said Jerry's control over him was becoming so oppressive and so ego-destroying and so limiting to his career that he finally made up a story. He said, Jerry, I'm gonna join the army. And Jerry said, "You're going to join the army? What are you talking about?" He said, I feel like I need to fight for my country. I'm going to join the army." And that was it. He said, "Okay, you're out of my life." And they escorted him off of his boat, wherever he was at the time. And that was the end of his association. Now I have an association with Jerry Lewis, which is in the book. Do you remember what that was? Okay, I'm not going to. It's not a test.
All right.
It's okay. And I have to warn you, Tim, it may not be in the book. I tried to remember.
I was going
to
say. All right. See, I was still working up a Sammy Petrillo joke.
Sammy Petrillo?
Yeah.
Now, that's really obscure.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm giving you a gold star now. Wait, I have to lick it, put it up on the wall.
Thank you.
That's next to my toothbrushing thing. Hold on. Let's put it over here. Into obscure references. There, okay.
Thank you.
It's sticking to the tile. That's good. So, Jerry Lewis, when I was in grade school, Alan Stevenson School, East 78th Street in New York, still there, great school, we collected money for the first Jerry Lewis telethon. And I, because of my prowess playing female leads in the annual Gilbert and Sullivan production,
right,
was asked to go and give him the check on live television, and I did. So I first met Jerry Lewis in person, giving him a check for my school. Years later, my uncle, Clarence Urist, who died like everybody else shooting a John Wayne movie called The Conqueror, which they wisely shot on a desert area in Utah where they'd been testing atomic bombs.
Right.
Okay? And they carted tons of that irradiated dust, irradiated sand, back to the sound stages. And my uncle and everybody else on that movie, including Duke Wayne, died of cancer.
Agnes
induced
Moorhead.
Induced by the radiation,
right,
from that. Okay, there's books written about it.
Right.
So anyway, but he was working with Jerry Lewis and his movies. And he, when I first came out to L.A., he took me onto the set of, I don't know, the Office Boy, maybe it was. It was an incredible set on a soundstage of like a cutaway side of a office building with all these various offices in it. But he showed me that Jerry Lewis had invented the see-through tape-recorded video playback.
Video playback, right. Yeah.
Because he was directing himself as the idiot, as he called that character, and he wanted to see if the takes worked. Many years later, I worked with a producer named Alan Katz, who was doing a similar show to No Soap Radio. I'm not sure what it was called, but I was Jerry Lewis's straight man in a couple of skits that we did together.
Wow.
And we always hit it off well. So then he cast me in one of his movies, which ended up being released under the title Smorgasbord. And it was, Cracking Up.
Cracking That's Up, right. Sure.
Which is another movie that I appear in with Peter Bergman that was produced by Joe Roth and directed by Neil Israel.
Wow.
But that's another story. So he calls his movie Cracking Up. And the scene that I was in was Jerry Lewis, when the movie's about the fact that Jerry Lewis gives up smoking and becomes suicidal. And Herb Edelman is his psychiatrist. He goes to a meeting.
Herb Edelman.
Herb Edelman.
Yep.
Yeah, great guy.
Yep.
He goes to his office for a session, and after it's over, he climbs out the window and goes out to the edge of a ledge, and he's going to jump to his death because he's so suicidal. And they don't know what religion he is, so they don't know. So they send out all the right. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to take a lap break. Hey, lady. Okay. And all these different people. Kip King was a rabbi who came out to talk to him. There was a Buddhist monk. There was a Catholic priest. And there was me, a Protestant priest. And we had to edge our ways over every other, you know, religious person who was there to get close to Jerry to say, like, my son, you do not have to do this. You know, as a member of my church, say, I'm not a member of your church. All right. And then finally they send his mother out. And this is on a ledge. Now we've got like Jerry Lewis and seven other religious clerics lined up. And his mother weighs 350 pounds. And she comes out, edges her way over all of us, all of our bodies, to get to her son. And the weight of all of us causes the ledge to collapse. And we all fall into a net below. Or Annette Bening, I don't know what it was. So anyway, this was a very elaborate gag, as you could imagine. They'd spent 2 years, you know, designing it. Jerry and his writing partner, oh, such a sweet guy, I can't remember his name right now, Bill Shepard.
Right.
Bill Shepard. And it was a hydraulic device that would lower slowly so we could all slide out, and then it would be undercranked so it looked like it was happening fast. Now, the day of the shoot, there was a little problem. And if you remember Spinal Tap, how they ordered the Stonehenge model,
right,
and they came up with the little tiny ones, not the big ones, that's what happened to this shoot on the soundstage you've been rehearsing on. The scenic department sent over a backdrop of New York that was supposed to be the long one was supposed to be, let's say, 50 feet by 200 feet. And that was the one that would drop down horizontally or vertically. And the horizontal backdrop was supposed to be like 20 feet by 60 feet. And they mixed them up. They mixed them up so that the backdrop of New York that was supposed to hang vertically was 20 feet by 40 feet. And the one of the, in any event, it didn't look real, and they scrapped the entire sequence. It cost them hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars at the time. Now, in today's world, it would all be blue screened or green screened or, you know, ice cream for ice cream, and they could have fixed it in the mix in a minute.
Right.
But no. They cut everything. I still get residual payments for my work in that movie, but I am nowhere to be seen. And now you know the rest of the story.